This episode contains discussion of issues which may be distressing or triggering for some, including domestic and sexual violence, racism, homelessness, and trauma. If you've been affected by these issues, help is out there. In the UK, you can call the National Domestic Abuse Helpline 24 hours a day on 0808 2000 24/7. Further details of the help available will be provided in the show notes of this episode. Welcome to Locked Out, a podcast from Commonweal Housing on the barriers to safe and secure housing for people facing social injustice. I'm Connie Muttock.
And I'm Megan Faraday.
And together with the authors of our new essay anthology, Locked Out, and other guests, we'll be exploring the social injustices in housing policy and practice in the UK, and how to build better housing solutions for those who need them most.
If regardless of immigration status, all survivors would be considered eligible automatically to support, that would make a difference substantially.
Inclusion is, it's a very fragile word because we can be there, but they can listen to us, but not really hear us.
Black and minoritized survivors of violence against women and girls face multiple barriers to safe and secure housing. Specialist organizations providing vital support to these women face shrinking resources and soaring demand. In this episode of Locked Out, we'll be asking why survivors of colour are so often prevented from accessing the housing they need, and how specialist Buy and For BAME charities can be better supported to serve their needs.
This episode, we're pleased to be joined by Cristina Ioannou and Gabriela Cavedo from Latin American Women's Aid, or LAWA for short, as it's often referred to in this episode. Gabriela is the director of LAWA, and has been part of the organisation since she joined as a trustee in 2011. She has over 10 years' experience as a planning, impact and learning professional, primarily within large international NGOs. Cristina is the specialist legal housing advisor for LAWA under the Women Against Homelessness and Abuse Project. She's also a qualified lawyer in her country of origin, Cyprus, and since 2019, she's been working closely with Latin American and Black and minoritised women to support them to navigate through the system and help explore their housing options when fleeing domestic violence.
Thank you, nice to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Amazing to be here.
So in the essay contributed to the anthology by LAWA, you spoke about the Roof Not a Home report that you produced, which highlights the structural barriers that are faced by Black and minoritized survivors in terms of accessing housing and facing homelessness. Could you start by telling us a bit about that project and those findings, and more broadly about the experiences of the women that you work with and the barriers that they face to accessing safe, secure housing?
So as a specialized organization, we're mainly focusing on the intersectional needs of our clients. Some of these barriers are based on the intersectional needs of Latin American and Black Asian minoritized ethnic women, like language, their immigration status, and then also the difficulties understanding and navigating through the housing system. Then mainly the reason why these women have more difficulty accessing housing than their white counterpart is mainly because they are facing discrimination. So it can be direct discrimination, mainly by the officers or the teams that they are dealing with the housing matters, or indirectly, like how the system is structured, for example, the laws, the regulations, and then also the common practices.
This research was the result of a two-year-long project in partnership with the London Black Women's Project, an organization that we've worked together with in this, but also the OYA Consortium, the partnership of Black and minoritized organizations providing refuge accommodation. And one of the main areas of our work is providing refuge accommodation for women fleeing gender-based violence of different kinds. Obviously, a key part and parcel of that work is accompanying women in when they are at risk of homelessness, as they are exiting the relationship that is violent, but also after they move on from being in our refuges, because our refuges are obviously, by definition, emergency spaces, and we wouldn't promote them to be there for longer than 6 months. However, in reality, and this is part of the definition of homelessness, and this is why this is an angle for very interesting for us, in reality, because of the different structural issues around the housing problems in the UK, what happens is that it's harder for us to rehouse them, to help them be rehoused. They end up staying longer in our refuges, much longer than they should be, really, which means that then less spaces are available for other women that are in the same situation. And so there's it's a vicious circle in a way. And one of the things that this report really highlights very well are these different phases that women go through when they're at risk of being homeless, or if not already homeless. So there's different experiences, you know, we've made some broad categories. So basically those that are precisely at the exit point of the violent relationship, then those that are already moving on or at the refuges. So there are housing issues that happen around that. And then what we call the move on and post move on phase, which are the phases where, well, when we are trying to bring them out of the refuges and into accommodation that is suitable and safe. And then their lives after that. But there are many, many barriers that they have in all of those different phases. So even if a woman is moving out of the refuge and is already has, in the best case scenario, a small flat for her and her children, even then, there are increasing barriers that they continue facing. So we've seen with the years that problems have become more and more complex, which is why we are now at a point where we actually need specialist advisors like Christina, whose only job or primary job is dealing with those issues.
People need support just to get information, which is the first step, like find where this information is provided. And this is something that we do when we meet the client. Like, did you know about your rights? Did you know that you can approach the local authority when something like this happens? And then moreover than that, the other difficulties that the clients face when they come into contact with different officers. And it's not only their intersectional needs, but it's also the response from the local authority per se. Officers have to be trained. They have to understand the importance of not re-traumatizing clients who have fled domestic violence by asking them questions that would trigger that trauma. And then moreover, not being discriminatory in terms of equality and in terms of human rights as well. This role became very, very important. And we can see that there is so much need about it. Hopefully we will get to the point that everyone understands their rights and there will be so much more clarity around the housing issues that victims of domestic violence and gender-based violence face.
Absolutely. So thinking about those barriers in the context of the last year specifically, as the coronavirus has forced more and more people to spend time in their home environments, we know that many Black and minoritized women who are already at increased risk of experiencing domestic violence have found it even harder to escape dangerous or unstable living situations. Christina, how has the COVID crisis impacted your work with survivors this year? And how have you adapted to meet their needs?
Coronavirus pandemic has affected every single one of us as an individual and then as professionals. But definitely we can see, and I've seen it on even the television, how it really impacted the domestic violence sector. We've seen a massive increase of domestic violence incidents during the lockdown, especially, but also as professionals, because obviously we had so much work that we had to deal with and we had to reorganize and restructure and working from home, which was a huge barrier, especially for organizations, I would say, that were not prepared for that online work. And then we had to find a way for us to communicate as professionals between us and then find a way to make sure that our clients had access to online resources. So obviously when you lack this face-to-face communication, it's very difficult to build the trust. The other thing is that obviously lockdown, you are very restricted of going out. So many of the victims had to spend a big considerable amount of time in their homes with the perpetrators. We still provide information online. We still try to reach them in that way. And they understand that, oh, this is what we have to do now. We can't see them. But if we need that support, we have to engage online. So it was a good thing for everyone to learn how to navigate through an online platform. Then on the other aspect of things, when it comes to the response of the councils and the response of the local authorities, we have seen that they also tried to promote online support. For example, many councils made the homelessness application online, whereas before it was just walk-in. Obviously, not being able to walk in at the moment, they had to make it online. And that was a very good thing because it means that when we have a case and we have to take immediate actions towards it, we could easily just go online and make an application, which was good. However, the downside of that was that there was such a demand, such a huge increase of victims of domestic violence with the lockdown that the local authorities were not prepared for. And although you develop an online platform and you perfect things, you should also develop the training aspect of it. So I could see this online response came promptly and quickly, but then on the other hand, I could really see that there was really lacking of sustainable plan for the clients. Because if you just provide them an emergency accommodation because they need it now, what about after? What about creating a plan that would help them go through the coronavirus pandemic, go through the lockdown, but also after it finishes, what do you provide them?
So what Christina has been observing, and we've discussed this, is that decisions come quicker, but then decisions are not necessarily in compliance with regulations. And you have, and we observed this in our report as well, we have a huge discrepancy in practices between different local authorities. That is something that we've highlighted in the report, we've raised it as a recommendation, because surely it would be in everyone's benefit that there is a consistency there. Also, we need to remember that this crisis came on the backdrop of a decade of austerity policies that were already disproportionately impacting the specialist services like ourselves and many others. So the questions that we ask ourselves as organization is what's going to happen after COVID? So every economic commentator and a specialist would tell you that there is a recession looming. We are already thinking, well, how can we prepare our services for that backlash? We know, and we've seen already that as the lockdown eases, you know, the demand is increasing even further, obviously in different ways. So what was happening at the very beginning of the lockdown, especially, we were observing a pattern where you saw cases coming through that were very high risk. You know, the level of risk, because they would only come to us at the very point of, you know, extreme risk. Or having a combination of different types of risk, let's say. Whereas now we're going to see even other effects. You know, for example, you know, what's going to happen with the mental health aspect.
Yeah, thank you so much, Gabriella. I think that was a really important point that you made about making sure we're not just thinking about the immediate impact of the pandemic, but also the long term and how the recession will disproportionately affect those more marginalized communities. So I'm interested in what you feel needs to change at the moment as we move out of the spring and summer lockdown, and as we kind of feel the full effects of the recession that will be coming as a result of this pandemic, what needs to happen so that the survivors that you work with at LAWA aren't left behind and aren't disproportionately impacted by that?
I believe really that beyond all the emergency responses, which are of course needed and very welcome, we need to couple those responses with long-term solutions. And you know, this is not something new as such, but because we've been saying it in the sector for many years now, but we really need, you know, long-term ring-fenced funding for our services, especially Black and minoritized organizations supporting women that are fleeing Vogue. I really would hope that when we reflect around COVID, we also always introduce this element of, okay, what about after? Because, you know, this is something that, you know, it will stay with us for some time. Our societies are all adapting, but we really need to be thinking through this beyond the crisis itself. Because, you know, the repercussions will be there. And the ones that are at the sharpest end of those vulnerabilities, you know, both as the users, you know, our women would be most likely be the hardest hit. And ourselves as organizations would also be the because we would be unfortunately less resilient than larger organizations that have bigger funding bases and increasingly more unrestricted funding. They will have the means to withstand the crisis. you know, the provision has been decimated. So I think over half of the refuge provision of the BME service refugees specialists have been shut down over the last 10 years. If I recall correctly, that's the figure. For example, during the first weeks of the lockdown, the availability of the refuge spaces was reduced 50% compared to the same period in the previous year. So what does that tell you? It tells you that because we had less spaces and more demand, basically half of the women we weren't able to accommodate. So we never turned down a woman. So this is one key important feature. We never turn down, and we always find a way to provide some kind of support to the woman if it's not physically possible, because say, for example, the situation is about service provision and we don't have the space, we would try to find the ways to refer her on to a service that is suitable. The kind of service that we provide is holistic and culturally sensitive. And that doesn't mean only because we speak their languages. We speak Spanish and Portuguese, you know, and of course English too. It's not just the language. The language is an important feature, absolutely. But it's about how we know what are the kinds of services and support elements that the women need. And we understand also from their own cultural, you know, point of view, how what would work for them, you know, what kinds of interventions would work for them. And we ourselves, we're all either Latin American or from a minoritized background. So this is the what we normally refer to as the led by and for. When we were able to slowly resume activities face to face, we were quite prompt to start doing that as soon as we could, because we knew that for us it was very critical to start being there in the office, even if in a reduced capacity, just so that women knew that they could call or they could somehow drop in. But since we aced the lockdown and we opened the offices, we started noticing more people calling to the office. We started noticing women approaching us and agencies approaching us in different ways. So we were also quite quick in coming into the new COVID world. So yes, you know, being a small, I guess it's complicated in terms of sustainability because of all the funding issues that I mentioned, but I suppose a positive element that we are quite nimble, no? So we are able to adapt quickly, and for sure we were quite quick into the crisis, able to really put everything in place, like Christina mentioned earlier, so that women could reach us some way or another.
Christina, just before we move on to solutions, can I just, going back to some of the kind of challenges that the people you work with face around housing, can you just talk specifically a bit more about what happens to those women that are in contact with mainstream housing options and some of the issues that they faced, but also particularly the experiences of women with no recourse to public funds and some of the issues that they've been experiencing?
Yes, definitely. Since the beginning, it has been very clear that there's a huge obstacle in accessing housing. And this can mean two things. First of all, providing all the information and tools available and ensuring that access to housing can reach the most vulnerable, including Latin American and Black and minoritized women. So ensuring that this access is going to be in a language that's going to be readable to people who do not speak English yet, or that it's going to be in plain wording and not in very hardcore legal terms for everyone to understand. And then on the other side of access to housing, it means that when you reach to the point that a case is accepted for a duty to relieve or a duty to prevent homelessness, the property and mainly the housing provider, the housing options provider, are adequate, which means that they truly represent the needs and specific circumstances of every woman and family. You can't really say to a family of three people that they have to stay in a studio. And then when you provide that studio, it's full of repair issues. So when we talk about access to housing, we mean the whole package of that. So finding a way for ensuring that women will be able to reach the local authorities and know how to get that information that is there, that is available to them, but not really is available to them. And then how to ensure that their rights will be implemented and fulfilled when it comes to housing, because adequate housing is one of the fundamental human rights. So that was one of the difficulties that we were facing, bearing in mind that our clients having multiple complex needs, including intersectional needs. And then on the other side of the spectrum, because I always see that as a two-phase situation. So what we can do and what we can improve and how to focus on the needs of our clients, but also what the local authorities and what the government can do. And on the other side of this, it would be good to have some more, as I said before, training, but not only on how to approach these matters holistically, but very specifically. So I would like to see more officers getting trained about intersectionality and understanding that you cannot really approach a person who has been through so much trauma and again, ask them questions that trigger different traumatizing experience. And then understanding how important it is to accommodate people who are fleeing domestic violence, that it has to be prompt, that it has to be quick. You have to have vital solutions for that. So I think that is also something that I would like to see, because if you cannot really offer that, then you're just creating a huge wall through this woman finding what they need to move on. So you don't really provide all the tools, you don't really provide all the information and the help and the support that they need. And then I think the most important aspect as a holistic, let's say, issue that I face during this process of access to housing is transparency of the process. So it's very important that we understand that every decision is made on a case-by-case basis. You can, well, obviously guidelines and the law is there, but there is a big discretion given to the officers and the teams and the local authorities. However, there are so many times that we encounter void and unjustified decisions, which when they are challenged, they were reviewed by the same people who issued them in the first place. So this, for me, really displays a fundamental issue when it comes to access to justice. And obviously, the coronavirus has had a huge impact on that, because apparently, as Gabby said before, there is a huge demand of cases. The local authorities are trying to do their best, promptly providing online support. But then if you need a very short amount of time to provide a decision and you rush providing a decision, not taking all the factors into account, you increase your possibilities of making mistakes and providing decisions that are not justifiable according to human rights laws, the Housing Act, and everything that is included in making sure that this access to housing is a path open for everyone who is allowed to access it. The pandemic and the lockdown just brought everything up to the surface of how we have to deal with things. And for me, it was a very good test, because then I could really see clearly where do we lack consistency, where do we lack understanding of the processes, and what practically has to be changed to make sure that access to housing is fulfilled.
Thank you, Christina. So on that point about the importance of consistency and understanding between you and other decision makers, do you have a sense of what specifically needs to change to ensure better consistency and more effective working between local authorities and specialist services such as yourselves? And thinking about what also needs to change at the national level as well, what kind of impact do you foresee from the new domestic abuse bill on your work with survivors alongside local government services?
I mean, what we want to see at the national level, and builds on what Christina was saying around transparency, is we need to see, you know, binding and robust accountability structures that are driven through the national level down to the local, and that the levels reinforce each other and support each other, so that there is really practices that are consistent across the board. So that's one. And what we were recommending to that end in our report last year was that the Ministry of Housing Homelessness Code of Guidance would be made binding for all local authorities. And I understand there is a process going on at the moment where that's going to be the duty, which to us is a positive development, absolutely. That said, we also really demand that we are made part of that. So we need to be at the forefront, I mean, alongside others, of course, but, you know, the Black and minoritized sector needs to be there at the table, really making sure that all of these very nuanced and complications that we understand inside out are really considered. Because otherwise, really, it's going to be probably more detrimental. And we've been working with our sector, with IMCAN, with London Black Women's Project, and with the rest of our partners in the OYA Consortium, as I mentioned before, with the MCLG as well. So we're very open and really keen to be part of the conversation. I think it's important to mention, now that you bring up the Domestic Abuse Bill, look, I have mixed feelings about that just because what I've seen so far, I know that it's now moving to the Lords. But all of the amendments proposed to support women with no recourse to public funds were not really upheld, basically. So the broader sector, especially in with campaigns, fantastic campaigns like Step Up Migrant Women, have been really working hard for a long time to make sure that all survivors of violence are considered eligible to being supported, not only in terms of housing, but in terms of everything else, regardless of immigration status. For us, this is an absolute fundamental principle. And we don't see that really truly being reflected. So I really hope, I know there's many champions working on this. LAWA has only very recently started to have a bit of capacity to work on that. If regardless of immigration status, all survivors would be considered eligible automatically to support in terms of housing and so on, that would make a difference substantially. So it's really important, you know, to have diverse pathways to bring women to our services. So, and that means, for example, a duty, important to reinforce the duty that police has to, you know, to apply different instruments that already exist. And we mentioned this in the report to you. We have the domestic violence protection notices and the domestic violence prevention orders. Those instruments already exist to remove perpetrators from the house, at least until, you know, the situation becomes safer. We have seen, and this is documented in the research, that that is really underused, if not altogether not utilized. So we really recommend that those kinds of existing mechanisms are applied more consistently and are made available for Black and minoritized survivors. I mean, probably it's worth repeating because it's so key, the training element, the comprehensive training. A lot of things can be prevented if only frontline workers in statutory services like the police and like local authorities would just understand and know. Now, the other thing about training, though, is that they need to understand that they have the responsibility to do it. Some of these agencies come to us saying, oh, great, so why don't you come and tell us what is, let's work together, quote unquote, so that we can understand how to work better with you. I understand that that comes from a good place, but in reality, we really don't have the capacity, truly, really, truly, to go and train you. So this is another point that for me, when we talk about training, whose responsibility is the training and how can we collaborate together in a way that is sustainable for everyone involved?
You just said everything that I wanted to highlight. Definitely accountability is a big aspect of that. So we really want to see ourselves there. We really want to see us having a seat on the table of discussions, because obviously nobody would know better than us as the representative of those women what those women need. So if we're not included, then definitely we will have gaps, not only gaps when it comes to laws like the Domestic Abuse Bill, but we'll have gaps in when it comes to practice and when those acts and laws will be implemented. Inclusion will be very important, but inclusion it's a very fragile word, because we can be there, but they can listen to us, but not really hear us. So if you just target and if you just aim to help people, but you don't aim to create a bridge between how these people can act as a community, as something belonging to a bigger group, then we're fundamentally failing in making everything better for everyone.
You're totally right, Christina, about inclusion and about participation. I would add there, though, that it is important that the terms of the inclusion are not imposed. And then the terms of the inclusion are really, truly responding to what we want to have, as opposed to a blanket assimilation, because this is not what we are about. So we really want to celebrate our cultural heritages. And we're very keen on just making sure that future generations of Latin Americans, some of them that will be born in this country and continue, you know, perhaps living here, we are quite clear that we are not part fully of this society. So this is a reality, right? So to me, when we talk about inclusion, we need to nuance it, because we need to be included, but whose terms is the inclusion? Are we really not only listened but heard?
Absolutely, Gabriella. And that's such an important way to phrase the importance of diverse inclusion for issues like domestic abuse provision. And we certainly hope that with all of your expertise at Lawer, you will be included in those ways more and more as local and national provision adapts to the challenges of post-COVID life. Just one final question for you. In this podcast, we're inviting all of our guests to spotlight the most exciting innovations in housing-based support services that are going on today. Whether that's something that you yourselves are developing or any other organisations that you know of, what would you like to highlight as we bring this episode to a close?
I can speak for the projects that we have in the pipeline. I think it's a very positive thing that this initiative that ended with this research that we published last year, so this was a two-year initiative. It was very positive that we secured further funding to continue these for further 3 years. So we want to refresh the research, but we would not probably seek to do a full-blown report in the way that we did last time. We would perhaps do shorter pieces that are available quicker, so the knowledge really circulates quicker. And taking in the positive side of the COVID, which was a lot of online, you know, activities are now common practice everywhere. So perhaps this could be one way of really disseminating this information and this knowledge in a way that really reaches the people that needs to hear these messages. So it's going to have a campaigning element of some sort. And at the moment, we're really just scoping how's that going to look like. But that's something we're really looking forward to, that work. And we're really looking forward to be more involved with the homelessness sector. Different sectors sometimes can be quite, you know, isolated between, no? So you have the Vogue sector, or the, you know, homeless. I mean, of course, there are forums that bring the two together, but it would be really interesting that these two sectors are further involved from the perspective that we bring in, which is the perspective of Black and minoritized women. Stay tuned, because we hope that we'll be able to share more details as they develop.
So before we end, would one of you just be able to kind of let our listeners know where they can contact you and any kind of resources you want to flag?
Sure, absolutely. So, I mean, our web is www.lawadv, as in domestic violence, .org.uk/EN, if you want to go for the English side. You would have also a possibility to go to the Spanish side and the Portuguese side. So in the landing page, you've got all the pointers there very prominently in terms of how to get help. You click on the get help section, then there's the prompt you to go to where we've got all these resources that we created in the, you know, during lockdown and many other things as well. There's also a section for news and blogs. And we would hope that you go and read our report that we've mentioned throughout the discussion, A Roof, Not a Home. And that's also available in our website. You can follow us on Twitter. So our handle is Lawer London, @LawerLondon. And on our Facebook page, of course, Latin American Women's Aid, all one word. And of course, importantly, if you go to our website, if you're someone that is seeking support or an agency that for some reason hasn't got, you know, the right email to address us, you can really go to our website, and on the bottom right-hand corner, you see popping up the chat function, and you would always have someone on the other side, I mean, always between working hours, always someone that can reply to you directly.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Locked Out, produced by Connie Muttock and Megan Faraday from Commonweal Housing. Do make sure to follow the show by subscribing wherever you listen to podcasts. You can find all our episodes, as well as the new Locked Out essay anthology for free download at commonwealhousing.org.uk/lockedout. If you'd like to find out more about any of the issues we discussed in this episode or in the Locked Out anthology, do get in touch with us by email at info@commonweal.org.uk. You can also tweet us your thoughts with the hashtag LockedOut and follow all our latest updates on Twitter at CommonwealTweets, one word. From all of us at Commonweal, thank you for listening.